then. I should have broken up with him right then. I wish to hell I had. Okay, look. I've done something kind of awful, he says finally. He puts his hand up to shade his eyes. I didn't tell you, but on a lark, I applied for a fellowship to go to Africa with Whipple. I never thought I'd get it, and to tell you the truth, I forgot all about it. But then, lo and behold, it came through. I found out a week before the wedding. He picks up a stick and pokes at the ground, drawing circles in the soft dirt. My ears are ringing from all the jungle noises around us. Lo and behold, I say, mocking him. Lo and behold, you happen to apply for a fellowship. On a lark. He stabs the dirt with the end of the stick. What the fuck, Noah? I know. I shouldn't have done it. No? If this is something you really wanted, then of course you should have done it. That's when you're supposed to talk about it. That's when you say to your fiancé, the person you're going to share your life with, hey, there's something I might like to do. What do you think? You're supposed to communicate with me. We shouldn't have gotten married. Why does it mean we can't be married? You think celibacy is a requirement for going to Africa? It hits me then, the true meaning of what he's saying. That the fact that he would, on impulse, apply for a fellowship without even telling me means that I am completely peripheral to his life. That's what this is. He was always so proud of the way we never fight. But maybe if you never fight, it only means you don't care enough. I try again. What if I come and join you? What if we both do this together? You'll see, I say. I can be adventurous, too. Oh, God, I'm being so pathetic. A monkey swings down from a vine, and I think he's going to smack me, but he only wants my granola bar, so I let him take it. Noah clears his throat and tells me he doesn't want any of the life we'd planned. Not the house in the suburbs, the three children, our teaching careers. None of it. I thought I could do it, he says. Really, I did. I love you, but just shut up, please. If there's any worse sentence than the one that starts, I love you, but, then I don't know what it is. You're right, he says. I'm sorry. And stop saying you're sorry! God! Don't say you love me, and don't say you're sorry. You fucking betrayed me, and you know it. How long have you known this? How long, Noah? You knew all along, through all the wedding planning, that you didn't want to do this, and yet you just stood by and let the whole wedding thing happen. You let me invite all those people, and you kept us all waiting, even though you'd known for weeks you couldn't do this. What is wrong with you? I wanted... Don't you dare talk to me about anything you wanted. You lied to me and embarrassed me, and now you're leaving me to go off on some fantasy trip that just came up. And when I say I love you and I'll support you, you turn me away. Like I'm just some object you're tossing out of the window, some useless extra baggage. You're not just some... I said shut up! You don't have the right to talk to me about what I am or what I am not. Listen, you idiot, I'm willing to give my whole heart and soul to you and work together on our dreams. We have to sacrifice. Nobody's happy all the time. Look at my parents. They have a very successful, long marriage, but do you think they were happy every single day? No one is happy every single day. And work is called work because that's what it is. That's what you do. No, he says, and his eyes are shining with sadness. No, your parents definitely aren't happy, and neither are mine. And that's just the point. I'm not going to do that. Fuck you, I say. He gives me a sad, knowing smile, and then he lifts his hand in farewell and walks away. Our surroundings have gone berserk, the heavy wet air filled with screeching and hollering, animals taking sides, flinging leaves and nuts at each other, raucously arguing, probably over the meaning of work versus love. I abruptly turn off the trail and go a different way down the mountain, and I walk furiously, with my head down, not caring if I ever see the hotel again, or him, or the airplane that's going to take me back to California. I want to throw myself off the cliff into the ocean.
"Oh, stop already. You're going to be okay," a voice says.
I say back to it, "I am never again going to be okay." But it laughs and says again,
"Nope, you're absolutely going to be okay.
You have a big life coming, a big, gigantic heart song of a life."
And I say back to it, "What the hell does that even mean?" He moves out as soon as we get back to our apartment in Burlingame, the place we have shared for 6 months. He feels it's best that he stays with a friend because, get this, he feels too guilty to look at me across the room. He needs to punish himself for hurting me this way. I hate the way he's almost getting off on all this suffering, how it makes him seem so heroic in his own head. The villain with the hangdog look, the guy who bows down and closes his eyes out of such sweet sorrow with his own bad self. Before he leaves me for good, backpack and suitcases overflowing, he tells me about all the decisions he's made without me. The one about how he and Whipple are flying to Africa in another month. Then one about how he's not going back to teaching. Ever. He looks at me with his new tragic expression and says he'll be in touch if I want him to be, which makes me laugh a high-pitched, maniacal laugh and fling the butter dish across the room. I think of how proud Natalie will be when she hears that I'm not putting up with being treated this way, that I am actually throwing crockery. And then I start to cry, because I know that I am supremely unlovable in a very deep, unfixable way. With great sadness, he picks up the pieces of the butter dish, sweeps up the shards, drops it all in the trash can. He tells me he's paid his portion of the rent for the next 3 months so I can keep the apartment without having to take in a roommate. He even leaves me the recipe for his secret 6-layer dip, the one with 4 kinds of melted cheese, red onion, and avocado, the dip that he never ever would tell me how to prepare. I rip it up in front of him while making hyena noises. He flinches, and I get louder. So this is what I've come to. Being thrilled, I can screech loudly enough to possibly scare him out of his mind. 7. Marnie. 3 weeks later, I come home from work to find a letter from an online divorce site. I drink 2 glasses of wine, turn our engagement picture toward the wall, and then I sign the papers that say I promise not to love him anymore. Soon after comes a copy of the decree. And just like that, I'm divorced. I say things to myself that get me through each day. I loved him for 2 years. We got married in an ill-advised ceremony. We broke up. I am still sad. I will fold my laundry and get around to sending back the wedding gifts. I will buy coffee and cream and eat oatmeal and cranberries for breakfast. I say, this is the poster on the wall. This is my kitchen table. This is my car key. I like coffee. It is Thursday. Then I do what McGraws do in times of great personal upheaval and grief. I go into full denial mode. I tell my emotions that they are now on stage 4 lockdown, forbidden to show up in public. I am, in fact, a denial warrior queen, bouncing into the nursery school where I work every day, playing the part of the happy little fulfilled bride with a big smile on her face. I don't tell anyone what has happened. I go in early and stay late. I smile so hard my face hurts sometimes. I think up approximately 7 art projects for the children per day, projects that necessitate cutting up hundreds of little construction paper shapes. As an added flourish, I make little books, one for each child, with stories in them of laughing cats and turtles that talk. I could tell my boss Sylvie what happened, I suppose. Sylvie would be outraged for me, and she'd take me home with her, and she'd tell her husband, and they would comfort me, and I could sleep in their guest room until I'm healed up. Sylvie is the most motherly person I know. I could fall apart around her, and she would know how to put me back together again. But I don't tell her the first day, and that makes it harder to mention on the second day, and then impossible after that. Maybe if I don't talk about it out loud, it will cease to be true. But because the universe is in the mood to test and toy with me, the bride talk at work increases exponentially. My life becomes a hilarious succession of bride stories, the ones I am begged for by the women I work with. Meatloaf for dinner tonight. Noah just loves it. Yes, we eat by candlelight. And then early to bed. You know how it is. And the ones the 4-year-old girls insist on hearing. They are obsessed with weddings and need to know every detail.
Were you like a princess that day?
They want to know, their eyes shining. Oh, yes, I was. In honor of my wedding, they wear white paper napkins on their heads at snack time and walk through the reading corner wearing the nap room blankets like long trains.
We are your bride girls,
they tell me solemnly, and I laugh and help them toss bridal bouquets. It's only at night that the bitterness comes for me, laying bare all my failures and misfititude. The bitterness has been at home all day long, pacing and waiting impatiently for me, and now it sits on the side of the bed, filing its nails and smoking cigarettes.
Ready now, sweetheart,
it says.
My turn.
That's when I see who I really am, when I know that I will never be all right, that the person who said he loved me and wanted to spend his whole life with me came to his senses at the last freaking minute, and then, like some kind of idiot, I still made him go through with the charade of a ceremony. I'm a misfit who can't pretend any longer, a dandelion in the lawn, an ugly duckling out paddling among the swans, hoping they don't notice. Then, after one sleepless night during which I think I will lose my mind, I jump out of bed at 5 a.m. and find myself punching in Blix's number on my phone. I can't believe I didn't think of this earlier. She is probably the one person in the world who could get him back for me. It's 8 a.m. in Brooklyn, and I somehow just know she'll be up. And sure enough, she answers the phone with,
"Hi, Marnie, my love. I was waiting for you to call."
I'm taken aback a little.
"You were?" "Of course. I've been thinking about you."
So I just blurted out,
"Blix, it's awful. I need your help. I know you can do things, and so I want you to bring Noah back to me."
She's silent, and it occurs to me that maybe she didn't get the news from his family that he left me. So I back up, tell her about the honeymoon, the fatal hike, Africa, the fellowship he applied for without telling me, Whipple, all of it, even the online divorce. She says,
"Oh, sweetie, I know this feels awful to you right now, but I need to tell you, honey, that this sounds to me like it could be the start of your big life."
My big life. Big life? My life has shrunk. I'm here in Burlingame where I cannot afford to stay, and I'm working at my job, and I'm going crazy, Blix. I just miss him so much, and I know you have insight and connections somewhere, and so I thought that maybe you could help me get him back.
She doesn't say anything, so I see that I need to keep going to convince her.
"Because I've thought about everything you said, and I really do need him. He's the best thing that ever happened to me, and something went wrong, but I want to fix it. That's going to be the big life, as you call it."
"You should come to Brooklyn," she says.
"Brooklyn? I can't possibly do that," I tell her.
Frankly, nothing sounds less appealing than going somewhere new, heading across the country to a city I've never been to. Being a house guest. Ugh.
So, then, tell me what you need.
Can you look at whatever it is you look at and see if he's coming back to me? My voice cracks. Would you do a spell for me to make me less ordinary or to make him not mind how ordinary I am?
Oh, honey, you don't want him back.
Trust me on this. There's so much. Please give me a spell. How desperate does a man have to be to break up with somebody on their honeymoon? How am I supposed to get over that? She's silent for a moment. Then she says in a quiet voice,
"Listen to me, sweet pea. Change is hard. And Noah is a high-level entitled brat who forgot to grow up. And I'm very sorry for the pain he's put you through. But trust me, there's something so much better waiting for you. You'll get through this and move on. It'll take time, but you will. So much better is waiting for you."
"No," I tell her. "It isn't. We were meant for each other. I know it. Just the way I knew that Natalie and Brian were meant for each other. You said yourself that I'm a matchmaker, and I know he's the one for me."
"No one can read their own stuff that way," she says. "Otherwise, I wouldn't have had to go through the cockroach and the dead on the inside man. Think about it. And by the way, you are not ordinary, and you need to come to Brooklyn."
"I'm ridiculously ordinary. I lose my keys all the damn time, and I am opinionated, and I get impatient, and I don't have any ambition, and I don't make enough money, and I couldn't care less about it. And when I was little, I dressed up cats in costumes, and I didn't care when they got mad about it." She sighs and says,
"Okay. Listen, I have to tell you something. When I was 18, my father died, and the family homestead I'd counted on inheriting was given to his sister instead. And that's when I realized that I could either live under my bed and be passive for my whole life, or I could do something that scared me every single day. So, being intelligent, I picked being passive, which was a great decision. Brilliant, in fact."
She laughs a little.
"So, I kept living with my aunt and trying to please her by doing everything she said and smiling nicely to everybody. And then one day my aunt told me that I was like my father. That I was a loser, and I was never going to amount to anything, and for the first time, all that anger I'd been pushing down simply erupted out of me. I was livid, beyond livid. So I scraped together the little bit of money that my father had left to me, and I went to Brooklyn, a place I picked on the map just because it scared the hell out of me. I had no idea what I was doing. I was out of my mind, terrified."
She's quiet for a moment, and I can hear her breathing.
"But it turned out to be divine intervention, or something, that I came here. Because after I arrived, everything changed. I made friends with the fear. I married a scientist I barely knew, and I went with him to Africa and studied bugs. I hated bugs! And I hated heat and snakes and traveling without knowing what to expect. But after that, I went all over the world. I chanted in India. I sailed on schooners that looked like they wouldn't float for 5 more minutes. I climbed mountains. I studied different religions. Whenever anything scared the living daylights out of me, that was a sign to me that I needed to throw myself into it. And you know what else? That's how I've lived my whole life, doing whatever scares me."
I don't want to tell her that that sounds like the worst possible life I could imagine, so I just say, "I'm always scared."
"Good. My sweet Marnie, you really should come see me."
"But I'm working," I say.
"Ah, yes, building up security and employment credits. Well, I have to support myself, I point out. No one else is going to do it for me.
She's silent for a long time, and I'm sure I've insulted her. But then she says, very quietly,
I want you to look very carefully around you, because everything is about to change. Your whole life. All of it. You need to notice it just the way it is right now. Will you do that?
She says some words I can't really hear. Is that the spell? I say.
I'm sending you my best words of power, she says. But yes, it's your spell.
I wish you'd come back home,
says Natalie one night on the telephone. She means back to Jacksonville, to live there.
Mom and Dad aren't getting any younger, you know, and I miss you. The baby misses you.
The baby isn't even born yet.
I know, but I tell her about you, how you defected to California, and she's very upset about it. She wants me to tell you that you're going to lose out on a lot of family experiences if you insist on remaining there.
I look out the window at the mountains and the park and the yellow brick library building. I've loved living here, walking to the perfect little nursery school where I work, then walking home through the town, window shopping and all the cool stores I can't afford. But now this town seems like a place that was never meant for me. Everybody I know here is already a member of a couple. I wave to them in the elevator of my posh little apartment building, smiling at each other, making their evening plans, with no interest in me whatsoever. Noah and I were like that, too, just keeping to ourselves. It's the same pang I always feel when I talk to Natalie. She and Brian always have music playing, and they're always fooling around, laughing like I guess happily married people do. And I wish Noah and I had settled down near my family, like I'd kind of thought we'd do at some point down the road. You know, meet them for dinner sometime, run into each other at the grocery store, have a big old extended family right there. But I don't want to go back to Florida alone, as the failed sister, the person who never figured out how to make it in the world. Besides, if Noah were to ever come looking for me, well, I'm just saying, this is where he would think to look, right here in Burlingame. He liked how upscale it was. He said he always wanted to live in the kind of town where the weekly police blotter reports were dominated by stories of residents bothered by squirrels tossing acorns too boisterously. Natalie reads my mind, which she is good at, having known me and my shenanigans for my whole life.
How is staying there a good idea for you? You need to get over him and move on, not stay at the scene of the crime, she is saying.
Costa Rica was the scene of the crime, as you call it.
Come home, come home, come home, she says.
And then Brian gets close to the phone and they both start chanting,
come home, come home.
One morning, after a week in which the bride girls have begged for us to put on pretend weddings at the preschool, I wake up with a fantastic idea. Probably the best idea I've ever had. I jump out of bed, jiggity-jig, and race around the apartment, pack up my wedding dress, the veil, the something blue, the somethings old and new, as well as the corsage and the bouquet, and I put them all in a giant trash bag. But I'm not throwing it all away. I'm not crazy or anything. I'm taking it to school. The most dazzling show and tell ever. I get there before the sun is even up, and I set out the dress lovingly on the art table. It looks so beautiful, laid out like that, so I put the veil across the chair. Noah was supposed to lift it off my face, so lovingly, smiling into my eyes. But, well, we didn't get to that part. I hear myself laugh out loud at the idea that things might have been altogether different if we'd done things the right way, lifting the veil for the kiss, having our first dance, tossing the bouquet, all of it. You can go insane that way. What if Whipple hadn't been the best man? What if there hadn't been a trip to Africa waiting? What if Noah hadn't realized all the stupid conventional things about me just before he was supposed to say I do? Conventional, That's what I forgot to tell Blix is my main flaw. I'm not simply ordinary. I'm conventional. Maybe I should call her back. I'll do that. Today. Later. But first, this. This! As soon as the bride girls arrive, I lead them over to the art table, where I take the scissors and make a nice, clean, long cut into the skirt of the wedding dress. I cut through the lace and the netting and the satin underpart. All the bride girls can have pieces of the dress to wear, I tell them. Their own little slice of the dress. I hear somebody say, "Marnie." And it's the kindest, softest voice I've ever heard. "Thank you," I say to the voice. It's the voice of kindness, of the universe ready to apologize to me for what happened. Only the voice has a person attached to it, and that person turns out to be my boss, Sylvie. She says, "Marnie, honey, are you cutting up your wedding dress?" And I try to say to her, "Yes, but it's okay." Although it comes out crazy because what's happening is that I'm suddenly crying too hard. And then she says, "Oh, honey, what's wrong? What are you doing? Let me get you a tissue. What has happened?" "We're going to make wedding dresses for the bride girls," I explain, "because I don't need..." And that's when I look down and see that I'm wearing my bathrobe and my bedroom slippers. And Sylvie, who is in her work clothes, says something like, "We should disappear into the back office while Melinda takes the children outside." And she gathers up the wedding dress pieces and the veil. And then she drives me home, even though it is still early in the day. We sit in my car outside my apartment, listening to the engine making that clicking noise it does after you turn it off. And after a long time, she says, "Marnie, sweetheart, I think you need to get some help." "Just because I went to work in my bathrobe?" I say idiotically. "I was in a hurry." Even I know how stupid this sounds. Then, very quietly, Sylvie reaches over and touches my hand and tells me that they've all known the whole time. Everybody. They all knew about the honeymoon and the divorce. People tried to talk to me about it, which I do not remember. Everybody has been sad for me. Nobody knew what to say. "That makes all of us," I tell her, laughing, but she doesn't laugh. Later in the week, there's a meeting, and the upshot is that I'm not supposed to come back anymore. In the write-up they give me, they say that they've decided to go in a different direction with the nursery school, by which maybe they mean they've decided not to let crazy people teach the children anymore. And they write me a check, which if I cash it means that I won't sue them or anything. My cheeks are numb from trying to smile through the meeting, from trying to insist that I really am okay. Sylvie walks me out to my car when it's all over. "This is going to turn out to be a good thing," she says. "Right now, you're just in shock, but it's time for you to move on with your life, and this is the push you needed." I hate that so much that I can't even. So much for the big life I'm supposed to be getting. So much for the love spell. And I just wish to hell that people would stop telling me that all my sucky tragedies are going to turn out to be good things.
8. Blix. I am going to die very soon, and I want a big Irish wake, even though I am not Irish. And even though you're supposed to be dead when they hold a wake for you, I say you don't have to be dead. There aren't any rules about wakes, not as far as I know. And if there are, there shouldn't be. I am here to change the rules on wakes. And anyway, I have so many people I've loved, and I yearn to have them all together so I can hug them and kiss them and tell them goodbye. I can give them little presents and tell them my wishes for them, and we will eat barbecue and big old salads, and drink whiskey, and we will talk and laugh and dance and cry. I want paper lanterns and twinkly lights and candles. I want a little seance, maybe, and loud music, and Jessica to play her lute, and Sammy to play the drums. We'll light the fire pit, and I'll burn things I don't need anymore, the things I want to offer up to the universe. I want us all to hold each other's hands and dance in a conga line. It's been too long since I've had a conga line, and when Cassandra has used up the best of me, it's going to mean so much if I can just remember that conga line moment, the moment I looked up and saw everyone I love all together. Maybe it would make the leaving hurt less. I'll try to talk Patrick into coming upstairs, even though he won't want to. But maybe he'll come because it's the end for me, and then he'll see that people are kind, and he'll change his life, start to be among the living again. Maybe I can find a way to tell him that there is love coming for him, that I know something surprising and miraculous and magical is lining up in the unseen realm. Maybe I can get him to believe. Before the good can happen for him, he's got to open himself up just a little, and believing in something like a conga line might be a good start. I tell Houndy we'll call it a blix out. He doesn't think much of this business of accepting death, but Lord, he does love a party. I know him too well. He thinks that if I have a party, it will be such fun that maybe I'll start answering the letters from the cancer center in which they plead with me to go through with our treatment plan. Who knows? Maybe they learn something after all those years in medical school and they can cure you, he says. Ah, dear, delightful Houndy, with his red, rough face and his white beard and squinty blue eyes, cloudy now from all his years of being in the sun without protecting them. I always tell him he has a poet's soul, all that sea in him, generations of it. He's been a lobster man forever, now transplanted to the city where he stomps around and acts like the land is a compromise he's made. Who in their right mind would have thought I'd turn out to be a lobster man's woman, going out with him on the boat between the Bronx and Long Island hauling in nets? But here I am. No, I say. They'll cut pieces off of me, and I need all my pieces. You don't need the pieces with cancer, he says. I do not think you need this cancer. I just smile because Houndy doesn't know what I know, that as stupid as it sounds, sometimes you have to live alongside the things you don't want, like cancer, and doing that helps you go deeper into life than you've ever gone before. If we all lived forever, I tell him, then life really wouldn't have any meaning. So why not embrace it, prepare for it, love what is? Who needs meaning when we've got this life, he says. He flings his hand out, taking in all of it. The apartment building, the chips of electric blue sky between the rooftops, the park across the street where the children shriek with happiness in the swings, and miles away, the sea, that he claims he can hear. But he doesn't know. I'm at the point where I'm all meaning. I'm not going to have a body much longer, but I am certainly going to have scads of meaning. At night, curled up next to me, he whispers, Blixie, I don't want you to die. And there is nothing really to say to that, so I just reach across the vast expanse of blanket and touch him. His hands are like big warm mitts, but somehow their shape is as delicate as stars. Houndy is made from stardust, that's for sure.
9. Marnie. How are you doing? Sylvie asks me on the phone 2 days later. I'm jobless and unloved, and I'm currently lying under the covers reading old issues of People magazine and eating granules of instant pudding out of the box is how I'm doing. I'm also having a little bit of a fascination with dust motes. I know. They're fantastic. But they're really more than fantastic. They have a lot to tell us about ourselves, these dust motes. If you stay still for a long time, they stop falling. But when you move again, wave your arm in the air or shake your foot in the covers, then they come swirling around again, like little stars, like whole universes. It makes you think, what if our world and the whole solar system are just contained on somebody's dust mote? What if we're that meaningless? I throw tissues at the wall. I pace around the apartment and dance to wild music until the neighbors downstairs bang on my ceiling with their broom handles. Maybe I could stay like this forever, suspended between worlds. But what I say is, oh, well, actually, I'm having all the feelings. Are you looking for another job yet? She asks. When I don't say anything, she says, I'll make some calls for you, if you want, when you're ready. You really are a very good teacher, you know. This has nothing to do with that. Later, I call Natalie and tell her the whole story, and she puts me on speakerphone so she and Brian can both work on cheering me up. They say all the right things, things I know I would say to a friend who'd called with this story. Wow, what a tough year you're having. Of course you're not crazy. You'll find something else. We love you. You could move back home. I chew on my knuckles while they talk to me so they won't hear me crying. I have to figure everything out, but right now I have a headache and I need a nap. Besides that, I need to watch the dust motes lit up by the setting sun before it gets too dark to see them any longer. So one day, without any warning, my parents show up. My parents live 3,000 miles away. When they show up, it means that airplanes and rental cars have been involved. And this doesn't happen without about a million conversations ahead of time. But here they are, banging on the door, calling my name like they're expecting to wake me from a coma. For a long moment, I think maybe I'm hallucinating their voices. Has it come to this? But then I realize, ah, of course. I should have known. Natalie and Brian have told them what's happened. I open the door tentatively, aware suddenly that I'm covered with flour and chocolate and wearing a too small Japanese kimono that my father brought back from Japan for me when I was 13 years old. I have on one bunny slipper and one sock, and my hair is a tangled mess because I have let the braid from 4 days ago turn feral, like a bramble you'd step around in the woods. I have been baking. Cupcakes with messages in them, if you want to know. Like fortune cookies, but cupcakes. When against all odds, Noah comes back to me, he will be so surprised to bite into a chocolate cupcake and see the message, "You are now with the love of your life." Maybe this could be a business. Cupcakes with messages. I'll have to come up with a better name, of course, but first I have to figure out how you can tuck pieces of paper into cupcake batter without getting them all wet. I've been puzzling over this for days, and so far nothing seems to be working. My mother puts her hand over her mouth. Her eyes fill with tears as she and I both take in the full horror of my situation. My father pulls me into his arms and hugs me. I start to cry. "We've been trying and trying to reach you," he says in a muffled voice. "Why don't you answer your phone? We've been calling you for days and days. We were out of our minds. Your mother finally said we should book a flight and rent a car and see for ourselves what's going on."
"I wanted to call the police," my mother says. "How could you do this to us?"
"I am so, so sorry," I say. But really, has it actually been that long? I might have lost some track of time. They come into the apartment warily, like they might be entering a crime scene. Suddenly everything looks awful. the sun shining on the countertop where I spilled eggs and cream and flour, and the little slips of paper everywhere, with their simplistic sayings on them, looking stupid and childish. Out of the corner of my eye, I see that my mother has picked up one off the floor that reads, "Who cares what other people think? Be you!" She hands it to my father and stares at me with round, tragic eyes. "Marnie, honey, what is going on?" "It's an idea. A business idea."
"A business idea?"
My father is all over business ideas. He looks at the slip of paper, and then at me, and then back at the slip of paper. It has chocolate smeared all over it.
"Throw that away, Millie,"
he says in a low voice. The trash can is overflowing, and the window has streaks of dust. The sink is filled with soup cans and spoons and a cardboard coffee cup that has something green floating in it. I was studying it earlier, that green mold. Mold is life, after all. And now that I look around, seeing the place through their eyes, I also notice that there's a red high heel in the middle of the floor and the picture of Noah and me at Lake Tahoe smashed on the floor by the heater. Yes, I smashed the picture with the high heel. So what? It was a satisfying, symbolic moment. I go over and try to scoop up as much as possible of the detritus of my life to hide it from them. But I can't hide it at all. And now that Natalie has told them that I've lost my job, they also can see that I haven't gone out and replaced it. Soon they'll point out to me that when McGraws lose jobs, that's when they double down. They start making calls, sending out flurries of resumes and curricula vitae. That's when a McGraw gets into gear.
"So, what happened to your phone?"
my mother wants to know. I look around. Where is my phone, anyway? How could I have neglected it? "Oh, yes, the phone. Well, the truth is, I must have forgotten the charger at work the day I left, and I honestly have never thought of it again until this moment. No wonder nobody has called me. I talked to Sylvie and Natalie last week, and then never bothered to recharge it. I have been so lame. Maybe I am having what they used to call a nervous breakdown. I don't really know what one of those is, but that does not mean I'm not having one."
"Oh, honey,"
my mother says. I expect her to say the things she wouldn't have been able to avoid saying back when I was in junior high. "Stand up straight. Comb your hair. And why didn't you do these dishes?" It's even scarier that she says none of that. Instead, she tightens the purse strings of her lips and sets herself to work, making things conform to the standards set by civilization. My father, clearly the designated hugger, comes over once again and holds on to me and says,
"You need some care."
They must be really worried if he's not going to ask why I didn't get another job yet, or why I was so awful as to get myself fired, or what I think I'm going to do next. Nobody says anything that would be upsetting. I close my eyes in gratitude. My parents are here, and I can stop running from whatever has me, because they are going to take care of me now so I don't have to adult myself anymore. They pack up my things, donate the furniture, clean the apartment, make the necessary phone calls, sell my old car to a guy down the street. And just like that, it's over. They are going to take me back home, back to the mothership, for repairs. 10. Marnie. When you fall apart and move back home, nursing a big heartbreak, everyone tiptoes around you, until one day they bombard you with all the opinions they've been keeping to themselves. But here's the thing I didn't expect. I actually don't mind their opinions. I am back in suburban Jacksonville, where I belong, back in the 1960s pastel yellow ranch house on the cul-de-sac where I grew up, 2 blocks from a Blackwater Creek in one direction, and the low-slung pink brick elementary school in the other. Old oak trees, dripping with Spanish moss, stand guard among the palm trees, the same as they always did. Nothing truly bad could ever happen to you here. That is, if you have the good sense to come in during the daily thunderstorm that arrives around 5 p.m. My father is sure that I need to find another job, but he is patient and willing to help me. He says I need something with security, health benefits, a pension. He talks to Rand Carson, my old boss at the Crab and Clam House, when I was a teenager. I was chief clam girl, I'll have you know. And when I make a face and tell my dad, "Not the fried clams again," he says I am in line for a much more senior position, dining room manager. I can boss the clam kids around while somebody else pays my health insurance premiums. My mother has another life in mind for me altogether, as her sidekick. She declares happily that we are joined at the hip as we make the rounds of her social life and errands, to the pool, to the store, to the library, to the gym, to lunch with her friends, and then we do the whole circuit all over again the next day. I am the prodigal daughter, welcomed back into the neighborhood, complimented for how I've grown up, for my nice smile. And it's true, I smile brightly at all the people my mother knows, which is nearly everyone in town. The neighbors who are outside watering their lawns need to run over just to get a look at me, as does Rita, the cashier at the Winn-Dixie, and Drina, who has styled my mother's hair since forever at the Do or Die Salon on Hyde Park Avenue. They all look at me with slightly pitying expressions on their faces. So, they know the whole story? Of course they do. But they understand. And then there's my sister, who lives only a half mile from my parents in a new subdivision that features the kind of dream house that two full-time professional incomes can provide. She is just about to begin her maternity leave when I arrive, and she is the perfect example of how a perfect person can make a perfect life. I know, I am using the word perfect too many times, and no life is perfect. But when I am with Brian and Natalie in their cozy house, with her cozy big belly, and the furniture all overstuffed and comfortable, and the walls painted muted shades of gray and beige with white trim, and the windows all clean, and everything looking peaceful and restful, I think that this is what everybody had been hoping would magically fall into my lap, too. I, myself, did not see it, frankly. Given a house like this, I'd be painting the walls real colors. Colors from the red family or the turquoise family, and hanging modern art on the walls. One morning, I'm having breakfast with my father out on the patio, just us, when he asks me what I see myself doing in my life. So I tell him the truth. "Well, I have a lot of plans, actually. I'm really into that idea of baking cupcakes with little sayings in them. Like fortune cookies, you know, but with cupcakes. And also, I'd like to write love letters for people who can't think of the right words. Oh, and I also would love to make costumes. Maybe do a stop-action film with figurines in costumes. I could write the scripts. Or say I could be happy, working in a bookstore, because I could help people find the novels they need to read for whatever is bothering them." He folds his newspaper and smiles at me. "We should try to narrow this down and see how any of it could be monetized," he says. "When you're thinking of what to do with your life, whatever your occupation is, it would help to think money." "Also, you're going to think this sounds crazy," I tell him, "but it's possible that I could turn out to be a matchmaker. I mean, I've had a few successes at it, so it's something maybe I could pursue." He gets up and ruffles my hair on his way to leave for work. "Ducky, I'm going to say it again. You're a fascinating human, but that's not what life's about. You got to make some money." It is not lost on me that this, Natalie and Brian's dream house, this is the reward for going to school and really applying yourself to a skill that people want and will pay for. You get to meet a nice person. And so what that he is maybe not the most zany, creative, handsome person you ever met? A guy who wants to play guitar all night long and write you love songs and then cook omelets at 3 in the morning, like the guy I married by mistake. But he is, instead, that other kind of man. A provider, an ethical, strong, good man with an eye to the future. Your future.
Ah, you see how it is with me? You see how Noah creeps in?
He has set up shop in my head with his goofy love songs and his Ray-Ban sunglasses and a storehouse of memories. Like the way he'd claim he had a special delivery for me of 1,000 smooches, and then he'd kiss my whole body, up and down, every inch of me. Both of us laughing until, well, until we couldn't anymore. There is no point in thinking about this, however. I'm in my real life now. Back where I started from. And where I will pick up the pieces. My room, still painted pink, smells like being a kid again. The light still slants in through the pink cotton curtains, just the way it always did. A slant that is so familiar, it may actually be installed in my DNA. Along with the sound of the hinges of my bedroom door, chiming like a musical note, and the flat yellow hall light shining up into the attic. Late at night, after my parents have gone to bed, I find my way to the family room, the lived-in, comfortable space where you don't have to pretend about anything. There's the same worn-out rag rug, the chipped bookshelves, and an old brown corduroy couch that hugs you when you sit down, like it's so very glad to see you. "Welcome home, Marnie," the couch says to me. And I sink farther into its soft cushions and let myself fall under its spell of safety and familiarity.
"It's so good that you finally came to your senses and came back home," says my friend Ellen one night when she and Sophronia and I meet for drinks and dinner. I've been home only 3 days, but my mom says I need to get out, and she's probably right. Ellen and Sophronia are both working for an insurance company in downtown Jacksonville and are dating multiple men from the corporate world. They tell me they have a social life that keeps them on the go, Margarita Mondays and Wacky Wild Wednesdays and Thirsty Thursdays. And then there are the weekends, parties at the beach with plenty of beer and dancing. Dating intrigue, that sort of thing. I can hardly remember that world. Maybe I wasn't ever really part of it, come to think of it.
"Oh, you should totally come with us," Ellen says. "It'll be good to get back out there. Get that guy out of your system."
Sophronia gives her a meaningful look, and then they both look sad for me.
"So, are you really over him, do you think?" Ellen asks.
"Yes. Oh, yes, totally. Over him, over him, over him," I say.
I'm glad they can't see the lump that has formed in my throat. They both reach across the table and hug me at the same time, and I remember how I used to like them in middle school, before we went to separate high schools and I lost my way, and they became part of the popular crowd at their school. The cool kids. They're still the cool kids, and maybe hanging out with them would be a good idea, now that I'm back here. We drink a bunch of beers, flirt with some guys, and then I get tired and sad and tell them I've got someplace I need to be. The corduroy couch is calling my name. Natalie and Brian come over for dinner my first weekend at home. I discover that they are now best friends with my parents. I am shocked, shocked, to realize that the four of them have rituals together. There is Sunday dinner. And then most Saturday afternoons, my father and Brian play golf while my mother and sister go shopping or go to a matinee. Also, my sister cooks extra for my parents on Mondays and Wednesdays, and my mother sends over some Thursday meatloaf each week. Even more startling to me is the fact that they get together at least every other week and play quadruple solitaire. There's a complicated scoring system that no one can quite explain to me, not without laughing so hard they give up. I stand there, amazed, while my mother and sister try to tell me all about it, with my father and Brian tucking in little helpful remarks here and there.
"And if you have more than a certain number of cards..."
"Red cards?"
"No, not just red cards, any cards. Just more points for red cards."
"Well, yes, unless your opponents have an odd number of black cards."
"Solitaire?" I say. "But Isn't that played alone? They fall over laughing at that quaint idea. I feel a flash of irritation mixed with envy, knowing that I can never catch up to them. We'll never truly be a part of their cozy little group. Natalie takes my arm and says, "Never mind, it's a silly game." My sister looks like an advertisement for pregnancy and happy marriage, like it's the least tiring thing ever. Her formerly long blonde hair is now chin length and cut at a sharp angle that makes her blue eyes jump right out at you. And although she's definitely wearing a huge round thing on her front, the rest of her looks perfectly slim and regular, like somebody came along and randomly glued a basketball underneath her shirt. And Brian, tall, handsome, dark-haired Brian, the personification of husbandhood and fatherhood, carrying the banner for good men everywhere, tells me about Natalie's brave march through pregnancy. "She's been such a trooper," he says, smiling at her winningly. "All that morning sickness stuff that some women complain about? Not Natty. She hiked and swam and worked full-time. I tell you, birth is going to be a breeze."
"Well," says my mother, "let's not tempt fate, shall we?"
My eyes meet Natalie's, and we smile. If people had themes, this would be my mother's. Don't anticipate anything good, or it won't happen.
"Marnie doesn't want to hear about all this," Natalie says quickly. "Let's talk about how awesome it is that she's moved back in time to be an on-site auntie."
"Of course I want to hear about all of it," I say. "I've missed out on everything. And look at you. He's right. You look absolutely gorgeous. You make pregnancy look like fun."
"Well," she says, "pregnancy is sociologically and scientifically the most interesting thing I've ever done. When you think about what's really going on in here. Like, did you know that a woman gets 50% more blood supply when she's pregnant? 50%!
"Astonishing," my mother says, rolling her eyes.
"Maybe you should sit down and rest. Take a load off."
She looks at me.
"Please don't get her started on all this. She starts in with talking about mucus plugs and breast engorgement and I don't know what all else. Gametes. Was that what you were talking about last week? Gametes?"
"That was at the beginning I told you about gametes," Natalie says cheerfully.
"Now we're at mucus plugs and breast engorgement."
My mother throws up her hands.
"Not in my kitchen. We will not talk like that before dinner."
Natalie says,
"It's life, Mom. Biology. Biology schmiology. Not everybody wants to hear about this stuff. It's like you think you invented having children."
"Wait, I thought you did invent having children," I say to Natalie. "Wasn't that one of your accomplishments? And I, for one, thank you for it."
"Now I have both of you ganging up on me," says my mother,
but she's smiling. She starts cutting up iceberg lettuce and plunking it into a bowl with carrots and celery. Noah's face rises up in front of me, and he says,
"Not even red leaf lettuce? Not even romaine?"
The men, of course, have headed outside with a platter of hamburgers and their beers. I watch them out by the grill, my father listening to Brian, and then laughing as they clink their beer bottles together.
"Hey, I'd like to chop up some vegetables to roast," I say, and my mom says,
"No need for that. We've got salad, and that's enough."
"But I like roasted vegetables," I tell her. Natalie winks at me. She goes to the refrigerator and gets out cauliflower and broccoli and peppers and hands me a cutting board and a knife, all the while telling me about the birth plan that she and Brian have figured out. No epidurals, no fetal monitors, no bright lights. Also, there will be soft alto flute music and a doula and a midwife. Brian will cut the umbilical cord, which they will then bury. The staff is to speak only in whispers. My mother puts her knife down.
"Well, I think you just want to make sure to do what they tell you. Although that's all a good idea in theory, please don't overlook the possibility of a good epidural if someone comes around offering one."
"I'm not having an epidural," says Natalie.
It's not good being rigid about these things, Mom says. If parenthood teaches you anything, it's how to be flexible. When you're a parent, you have no control. None. Might as well start getting used to that now, Missy.
Natalie turns to me, smiling her high-wattage fake